But we get things underway this afternoon by welcoming back to the program one of our absolute favorite guests. You know him from work throughout the years in film and television, from Blade Runner to Newhart to, of course, his incredible role as E.B. Farnham on Deadwood and the upcoming Deadwood the movie. He is the author of a tremendous new memoir entitled Yes, I'm That Guy, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Character Actor. Happy to welcome William Sanderson back to the program. Bill, thanks for coming back with us.
Thank you very much.
Love this book so much. I told Sharon, I picked it up and I just read the whole thing at once. I couldn't put it down. It was such a tremendous read.
Well, I don't know what to say except I'm surprised because I'm always looking at the worst scenario. But I'm hopeful and I'm grateful. Thanks again.
Well, we loved it. And we've asked you this before when you were talking with us about the book and your reasons for it. Part of this is, as you point out, to have a legacy of sorts, to make sure that even though your work in television and film will be out there for a long time, well, when you put it in a book, it's there forever, but also to maybe correct any perceptions that might be out there of you and what you're like, and to let the world know that you're an educated man, you've got a law degree, you know your stuff.
Well, yes, but I don't want to leave out vanity. I keep thinking as I'm asked questions, why'd you write it? But I hope maybe to change some opinions. Someone said, look at the roles he played. As I may have said to you before, I played a lot of idiot types, but I don't think that that's a sum total. So thank you.
Well, let's talk about your early years growing up in what was clearly a challenging situation. Your mother sounds like an absolutely incredible, strong woman.
Yeah, she was, and did everything for my brother and me, and kind of put her life, her own dreams on hold for the family. But I want to be careful here that I did all right, and that's largely because of her, you know. But the father did a lot of disciplining and telling me, trying to make me do the right thing. He just, it didn't quite, had a little hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. But I love this book I read about Santana, and he said, don't cry at your own movie. I ended up pretty good.
You sure did. Well, you found some trouble in those early years in junior high and along the way, but you also show an amazing tendency in your life to get out of trouble when things perhaps could have gone a lot worse for you.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Second chances, second opportunities, and I just read something about that the creator of Deadwood said about second chances. So it made me feel good. It came out in the New Yorker, an article. He has dementia now, but that made me feel good when somebody intelligent says the same thing. But the second, you know, the juvenile offense, I didn't think that would last. But when I went in the Army, they had to give me a waiver. So I thought, man, everybody's going in the service. It's a 6-year obligation. So, but I'm just rambling on, and instead of talking coherently, but I did get a lot of second chances. But I acted like an adolescent even when I got out to Hollywood. But part of that was getting that 15 minutes Warhol talks about fame, and you suddenly people like you better for some reason, and I fell for it.
We're talking with William Sanderson here on Downtown. You've chatted with us a little bit about the influence of Elvis growing up in Memphis when you did. There are some incredible Elvis stories in the book, from seeing him in the middle of Bob Neal's record store. Could you share a little bit of the story? And we still want people to go read the book, but a little bit of what happened. You actually visited Graceland with Elvis there with one of the guys who owned Lansky's clothing store, where Elvis got all his duds.
A few people have called, and thank goodness I didn't tell them the stories. I said, well, I'm not going to give them that story. I'll put it down. But I don't know how well I tell that one. I don't want to give it away completely. There's Which one do you think, Bob Neal Record Shop or the when he was playing the piano in his house?
Well, that was a pretty good. Actually, I think my favorite, though, is Elvis and you, because you just sort of inserted yourself into the Memphis Mafia, knowing where he was going to be. It was at the amusement park when you ran into him a little too hard doing the bumper cars?
Oh, yeah. I had a friend who was a friend of the Blackwood Brothers, a gospel group, and the Blackwood Brothers always knew what night Elvis was going to the Memphian and rent the theater or amusement park. He would go out at midnight. So I did slide in a side gate, and it was a crowd of mostly his friends and stuff. So Elvis had his buddies on one team, and I jumped in. They call them Dodger bumper cars, and like an idiot, I was hitting head-on with the car, and he said, man, I told you not to do that. And, boy, I just apologized like crazy. I'm sorry. And he almost immediately, he said, oh, it's okay. I just hate to keep replacing the motors. But if he was anything, he was always pleasant to the fans. And I call myself a stalker later, or I should say groupie now. But I drive down to Mississippi. Most people didn't know he had a ranch down there. And I might stand outside the gate just waiting for him to drive out. Priscilla, I was a little bit obsessed, but got to see him from grade school and junior high and high school. So not when he became older, the caricature, I call it, of Elvis. But he was a very generous person and sparked a dream, as Keith Richards said, he sparked a dream.
Yeah, I mean, in the book, you talk about the concerts that you got to see. You know, so growing up in the same city, you saw Elvis three times before you were 13 years old?
Well, the first time I was 11 or 12, probably sixth grade, and that was an outdoor concert. We call it like a Hollywood Bowl, only this one would hold 5,000. So he played there, and I started around dusk, and Sam Phillips was in the audience, and I was on the front row, I believe. But then the next year was when I, hanging around Lansky Brothers on Beale Street where he bought his clothes, and Mr. Lansky, am I making it too long?
No, not at all.
Mr. Lansky knew that his son was in my mother's third grade class, so I guess that gave me a little. So I'm 13, I think, in the seventh grade. He said, you want to ride out to the house, and I have to deliver some clothes. So I did. And Sharon said, don't tell the whole story, but I did get to go in the house, and I'll just say he was playing the piano, and in the book I say the songs that I can remember. And his buddies were around the piano, but I thought it was a dream. I'm sitting there, a big white piano with gold trim and white television. And within the next, I'll just cut the story off, but his mother came down to listen to it, leaning against the doorway. But within a couple of years or so, he was the highest paid entertainer in the world. And I thought, God, you know, so.
And he was a big...
A lot of fun. Then got to play after he got out of the Army, and I got older, and he got to play a little football with him on
Sunday night. Right.
Until it got so popular that I couldn't even grab a jersey.
Well, and he was an influence on you, as he was millions of young people, in terms of fashion. Have you ever felt better about yourself than you did when you were sporting that turquoise rock and roll shirt?
Oh, thank you for remembering that. I think my mother bought that. But rock and roll, we kind of claim that it started there. A lot of people will argue with you. But and the great black artists, and I got to see them live. And, you know, there was Jerry Lee Lewis whom I saw, Johnny Cash. I didn't see Roy Orbison. He recorded there. No, I like that shirt. And I still like turquoise, but I was probably wanting to be a rock and roller.
William Sanderson's book is called Yes, I'm That Guy, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Character Actor. You went to law school, wandered into a theater class, and that was a life-changing event for you in many ways.
Yeah, it sure was gradual, but it was fun, and I always wanted to get over shyness, whatever I ended up doing. So I think I discovered at a local theater with a good teacher, you can still be shy and act. So you just put the right stuff in your head. It took a while. You know, the apprenticeship in New York was probably the biggest help, the stage plays and things. But law school, yeah, I should tell them I never took the bar exam, but I made some good friends, and to this day, and I don't regret going to law school. I read once about Sinatra, whom I love to hear sing, but he said he got self-conscious when he went into groups of intelligent, educated, or you know what I'm saying, and I don't.
Right. Now
I would be for some other reason, but not because they dazzled me with their intellect.
Well, when you moved to New York, that was an interesting experience. You were tending bar, you were acting, and you were getting in some more trouble. And as you point out, you're so honest and open about it throughout the course of the book. You prove time and again that Bill Sanderson and alcohol makes for a very combustible mix.
Yeah, and I was fearful that everybody thinks they were wild or outlaw type, but bartending, you're pretty close to it, and it's free, but I had a real good probation officer, and that helped, but I had some close calls by being arrested and doing dumb things, but those second chances, That article about, I better be quiet about that. I don't know how much to talk about it, but to try to get somebody to read the book, the arrests were in double figures. But the biggest one, the scariest one, was out in California was a shakedown, and actually more than one shakedown. I only can imagine what these stars do and happened. And I said to my buddy one time, well, the Elvis didn't let that happen. And my buddy said, he paid them off.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know, but, you know, you just become a target sometimes. But, you know, it was much my fault as anybody else's, I guess. But how many, the second chance to get out, you know. I was fired a lot of times, and I've realized it goes on in business, and then rehired by the same people.
Right.
It's weird.
Well, you made your way west into the movies, getting some help from Joseph Wamba along the way, and then a really wonderful experience, it sounds like, working on Coal Miner's Daughter with Sissy Spacek, and a guy that you came to work with quite a bit, and an equally volatile character in the book, Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh, thank you for mentioning both of them. I survived six projects with Tommy, and they asked me to do a seventh, but I couldn't get out of another job. But Sissy Spacek, a class act, I started to get a little success, you know, and I would see how she handled a compliment. Somebody would say something nice to her, she'd just say thank you. And it's not that easy. I've seen Bob Newhart talk about it. He's such a friend of Carson's, and he said, somebody says you did a good job, and you say, oh, no, I dropped the ball, or I didn't do that well. Newhart says you get two compliments, because they come back and say, oh, yeah, you were really good, instead of just saying thank you. Did any of that make any sense?
It sure did, yeah. I was very pleased because he's one of my favorite actors of all time, and you're the second person that will tell us good things about James Garner here on the show. The other was Julie Andrews, who absolutely loved working with him back in the Americanization of Emily, and he is, as you put it in the book, a real mensch.
Oh. Couldn't say enough, you know. And another sad thing, they rebooted or they did one season of Maverick.
Mm.
And so I tell in the book about how nice he was to explain what you have to do when they reverse the camera angle. Mm. And he said that we're going to use you when they bring the show back next season. And they didn't bring it back because of some argument between Mr. Garner and the producer, but he was also nice to my son at a Raiders football game. But I think he's known as a classic guy himself.
Also, now we've talked with you before about the new heart experience, but I thought it was interesting that nobody is one-dimensional, and Bob Newhart certainly was a guy who cared about the people he worked with, but you also point out in the book he was pretty protective of what he had, wanted to make sure that people didn't cash in on those roles that he felt his show provided.
Well, that and Levy's show, I've done a lot of thinking. If you give somebody a job, and first chance they get, they want to go somewhere else. He figures that he gave you the shot. So his manager was the head of MTM, so he had great power, like a Jackie Gleason or somebody. But I learned a lot from him, and I liked the way he treated the crew. They had done his old show on the same stage, so he knew them by first name. And he's still, he still works. Sometimes I think he still does shows. He's 89. I was lucky to be a small part of that show with my brother Daryl, Tony Pappenfuss, and John Volstead.
I also, you made both Carrie and I really want to see a movie that you did not that long ago. That sounds like a wonderful experience. Can you share a little bit about Stanley's gig?
Oh, my goodness. The script was wonderful, and it's about a guy who dreams of, he's a ukulele player, and he dreams of playing on a cruise ship. In real life, it's based on a true story. In real life, the guy was drunk, and he found salvation by working in an old folks' home. But we had a first-time director, and they chose to do it with a low budget. Someone said, the director was offered a lot of money to sell it to Universal, and they said they'd give it to Robin Williams. But it didn't do much. They didn't promote it. I think Stars played it. It had Marla Gibbs, who's a wonderful singer. And an actor named Stephen Tobolowsky. Has he been on your show?
He's a great friend of our show. He's been on many times.
Yes, he was on there and Faye Dunaway, which when right. I got this independent film, I thought, that's a good name to drop. But I tell a story in there about her. I hope people will read the book. She's a diva, and I keep my mouth shut around her.
But very professional as well, as you point out. Read the book to get the story. Let's talk about Eustace Bailey Farnham. You say it's the high point of your acting career. What did that opportunity to be in Deadwood do for you?
Well, besides buy a second home back here, modest home in Pennsylvania, It was just great writing. David Milch, which I keep mentioning, I'm so sorry that he's ill now, but everybody on the show was lucky enough to go on to another show. And I know it's not everybody's thing because it has some rough language, but it was based on my character, the mayor, based on a real character, but he decided to make him some... David decided to make my character something of a buffoon, but that's all right. That's all right. I think it's why I got the next job on True Blood, because had I not done Deadwood, I might not have gotten that one. But I don't know how to describe it without sounding like I'm bragging. I got to be in every show, and there's only two of us for some reason, Ian McShane and I. And that's kind of lucky for a character actor.
Well, and to
I
deliver
felt like a walk on, I felt like a walk on,
and to deliver some incredible monologues.
Yeah, he seemed to give everybody one, and I put some of them down in the book. I hope it's legal that he gave, and that were in some articles. But his incredible. I've never read anything somebody said, so I don't want to take too much of your time.
You can never take too much of our time, Bill.
Well, I'll try to make it quickly. In this article I just read, And he, the author's talking about Milch's dementia, and he said, "Well, would you like you do you go to a place like Deadwood? Would that help you clear your head?" And David said, "I think that is the chief blessing of art, the opportunity to organize one's behavior around a different reality." Then he said, "It's a second chance. You pray to be equal to it."
Mm.
That's, I mean, you know, I talked about second chances.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, one of the points you make, and I found it a really interesting point in your book, that the character of E.B. Farnham is in some ways reflects some of what Milch thinks of himself. And so you became almost an extension of him within the show.
Well, they've said, if I heard what I was saying, I think people would say, that guy takes himself very seriously. I think sometimes authors, their alter egos, those characters in the novels and books. But David is part Swearingen, the tough guy, the vulgar mouth, and he's tender at times when he writes the parts for the women. And he's funny. He's funny. And my character just kept surprising me, and that's. But I do think a lot of it is David, yeah, and some of his family or people.
When you talk about second chances, have you had a bigger second chance than your wife Sharon?
Oh no, I bet I talked about it before. I couldn't even organize my little schedule right now without her coordinating interviews and things, and I couldn't get on a plane. They invited us to Deadwood premiere, and I wasn't able to go because a lot's happening back here. But it's always more work for her, and I looked up a word, uxorious. Did I say that before? Is too much
no.
Credit for one's spouse or wife, but maybe I could lighten it by saying she's very smart. I hope she doesn't leave me.
Well, the book is, in many ways, also a wonderful love story about you two. And I love the stories. It's been an amazing ride for you through the years. But to me, what made the book so powerful, and I told Sharon, I teared up at the end of it, because it seems like as you settle in here to what you call your semi-retirement, we hope it's no more than that, but it seems like you've been able to find some peace of mind. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, but what you say scared me. I don't have the stamina and energy. Did you just have Paul Dooley on your show?
We did, yes.
My God, do you think that doesn't make me humble? Talk about a character actor. And I know one time I said, who got the job? I auditioned for something. They said, oh, a guy named Paul Dooley. And I said, well, you don't mind losing a job to someone like that. I'd sure do segue, don't I? But I really appreciate what you're saying. I'm sure I'm stealing somebody's words, but if they read it, boy, you say compliments and that throws people. Find out who the real hero is.
Well,
reading the pages.
We love the book. I couldn't get enough of it. It's one of those books I know I'm going to reread again. And I know you don't like getting those compliments, Bill, but it's an inspirational book. It's a powerful book. And, man, I hope more and more people read it. Yes, I'm that guy, the rough and tumble life of a character actor.
I thank you. Rough and tumble life of a character. I live for compliments, but I try to hide it. There's a Jackie Gleason said self-deception thrives in the compost of flattery, and I trust you. I love doing the show, but out in Hollywood, that's how they motivate you, you know. And so, but you made my day.
Well, you made ours by being with us. We love the book. We wish you great success with this. Just what about 10, 11 days until the Deadwood movie comes out. We look forward to seeing that as well. And we wish you and Sharon nothing but health and happiness, and hope to have you back again before too long.
Oh, it's an honor to be on your show. And I'm full of the S word sometimes. Take care, okay?
Thank you, Bill. It's Bill Sanderson, the book, Yes, I'm That Guy. Get it. It's available on Amazon.com. The official release date is coming up on Thursday of this week, but you can pre-order it right now. And it really is a tremendous book with amazing stories. Just for the Elvis stories alone, it's worth the cost, but it goes beyond much more than that.